Disc 2.
At Gossington, Mrs. Bantry and Miss Marple were sitting in the drawing-room. "You know," said Mrs. Bantry, "I can't help feeling glad they've taken the body away. It's not nice to have a body in one's house." Miss Marple nodded. "I know, dear. I know just how you feel." "You can't," said Mrs. Bantry. "Not until you've had one. I know you had one next door once, but that's not the same thing. I only hope," she went on, "that Arthur won't take a dislike to the library. We sit there so much. What are you doing, Jane?" For Miss Marple, with a glance at her watch, was rising to her feet. "Well, I was thinking I'd go home, if there's nothing more I can do for you." "Oh, don't go yet," said Mrs. Bantry. "The fingerprint men and the photographers and most of the police have gone, I know, but I still feel something might happen. You don't want to miss anything." The telephone rang and she went off to answer. She returned with a beaming face. "I told you more things would happen. That was Colonel Melchett. He's bringing the poor girl's cousin along." "I wonder why," said Miss Marple. "Oh, I suppose to see where it happened and all that." "More than that, I expect," said Miss Marple. "What do you mean, Jane?" "Well, I think perhaps he might want her to meet Colonel Bantry." Mrs. Bantry said sharply, "To see if she recognizes him. I suppose... Oh, yes, I suppose they're bound to suspect Arthur." "I'm afraid so." "As though Arthur could have anything to do with it." Miss Marple was silent. Mrs. Bantry turned on her accusingly. "And don't quote old General Henderson or some frightful old man who kept his housemaid at me. Arthur isn't like that." "No, no, of course not." "No, but he really isn't. He's just, sometimes, a little silly about pretty girls who come to tennis. You know, rather fatuous and avuncular. There's no harm in it, and why shouldn't he? After all," finished Mrs. Bantry, rather obscurely, "I've got the garden." Miss Marple smiled. "You must not worry, Dolly," she said. "No, no, I don't mean to, but all the same I do a little. So does Arthur. It's upset him, all these policemen prowling about. He's gone down to the farm. Looking at pigs and things always soothes him if he's been upset. Hello, here they are." The chief constable's car drew up outside. Colonel Melchett came in, accompanied by a smartly dressed young woman. "This is Miss Turner, Mrs. Bantry, the cousin of the victim. "How do you do?" said Mrs. Bantry, advancing with outstretched hand. "All this must be rather awful for you." Josephine Turner said frankly, "Oh, it is. None of it seems real, somehow. It's like a bad dream." Mrs. Bantry introduced Miss Marple. Melchett said casually, "You're a good man about." "He had to go down to one of the farms. He'll be back soon." "Oh." Melchett seemed rather at a loss. Mrs. Bantry said to Josie, "Would you like to see where it happened, or would you rather not?" Josephine said after a moment's pause, "I think I'd like to see." Mrs. Bantry led her to her library with Miss Marple and Melchett following behind. "She was there," said Mrs. Bantry, pointing dramatically, "on the hearthrug." "Oh!" Josie shuddered, but she also looked perplexed. She said, her brow creased, "I just can't understand it. I can't." "Well, we certainly can't," said Mrs. Bantry. Josie said slowly, "Isn't the sort of place," and broke off. Miss Marple nodded her head gently in agreement with the unfinished sentiment. "That," she murmured, "is what makes it so very interesting."
"Come now, Miss Marple," said Colonel Melchett good-humouredly, "haven't you got an explanation?"
"Oh, yes, I've got an explanation," said Miss Marple, "quite a feasible one. But, of course, it's only my own idea." "Tommy Bond," she continued, "and Mrs. Martin, our new schoolmistress. She went to wind up the clock, and a frog jumped out." Josephine Turner looked puzzled. As they all went out of the room, she murmured to Mrs. Bantry, "Is the old lady a bit funny in the head?"
"Not at all," said Mrs. Bantry indignantly.
Josie said, "Sorry, I thought perhaps she thought she was a frog or something."
Colonel Bantry was just coming in through the side door. Melchett hailed him
and watched Josephine Turner as he introduced them to each other. But there was no sign of interest or recognition in her face. Melchett breathed a sigh of relief. Curse Slack and his insinuations! In answer to Mrs. Bantry's questions, Josie was pouring out the story of Ruby Keene's disappearance. "Frightfully worrying for you, my dear," said Mrs. Bantry. "I was more angry than worried," said Josie. "You see, I didn't know then that anything had happened to her." "And yet," said Miss Marple, "you went to the police? Wasn't that, excuse me, rather premature?" Josie said eagerly, "Oh, but I didn't. That was Mr. Jefferson." Mrs. Bantry said, "Jefferson?" "Yes, he's an invalid." "Not Conway Jefferson, but I know him well. He's an old friend of ours. Arthur, listen, Conway Jefferson, he's staying at the Majestic, and it was he who went to the police. Isn't that a coincidence?" Josephine Turner said, "Mr. Jefferson was here last summer, too." "Fancy, and we never knew. I haven't seen him for a long time." She turned to Josie. How is he nowadays?" Josie considered. "I think he's wonderful, really. Quite wonderful, considering, I mean. He's always cheerful, always got a joke." "Are the family there with him?" "Mr. Gaskell, you mean, and young Mrs. Jefferson, and Peter?" "Oh, yes." There was something inhibiting Josephine Turner's usual attractive frankness of manner. When she spoke of the Jeffersons, there was something not quite natural in her voice. Mrs. Bantry said, "They're both very nice, aren't they? The young ones, I mean." Josie said, rather uncertainly, "Oh, yes, yes, they are. Yes, they are, really." "And what," demanded Mrs. Bantry, as she looked through the window at the retreating car of the Chief Constable, "did she mean by that? They are, really? Don't you think, Jane, that there's something—" Miss Marple fell upon the words eagerly. "Oh, I do, indeed I do. It's quite unmistakable. Her manner changed at once when the Jeffersons were mentioned. She had seemed quite natural up to then." "But what do you think it is, Jane?" "Well, my dear, you know them. All I feel is that there is something, as you say, about them which is worrying that young woman. Another thing, did you notice that when you asked her if she wasn't anxious about the girl being missing, she said that she was angry, and she looked angry, really angry. That strikes me as interesting, you know. I have a feeling, perhaps I'm wrong, that that's her main reaction to the fact of the girl's death. She didn't care for her, I'm sure. She's not grieving in any way. But I do think very definitely that the thought of that girl, Ruby Keene, makes her angry. And the interesting point is, why?" "We'll find out," said Mrs. Bantry. "We'll go over to Danemouth and stay at the Majestic. Yes, Jane, you too. I need a change for my nerves after what has happened here. A few days at the Majestic, that's what we need. And you'll meet Conway Jefferson. He's a dear, perfect dear. It's the saddest story imaginable. Had a son and daughter, both of whom he loved dearly. They were both married, but they still spent a lot of time at home. His wife, too, was the sweetest woman, and he was devoted to her. Well, they were flying home one year from France, and there was an accident. They were all killed. The pilot, Mrs. Jefferson, Rosamond, and Frank. Conway had both legs so badly injured they had to be amputated. And he's been wonderful. His courage, his pluck. He was a very active man, and now he's a helpless cripple, but he never complains. His daughter-in-law lives with him. She was a widow when Frank Jefferson married her, and she had a son by her first marriage, Peter Carmody. They both live with Conway. And Mark Gaskell, Rosamond's husband, is there too most of the time. The whole thing was the most awful tragedy." "And now," said Miss Marple, "there's another tragedy." Mrs. Bantry said, "Oh, yes, yes, but it's nothing to do with the Jeffersons." "Isn't it?" said Miss Marple. "It was Mr. Jefferson who went to the police." "So he did. You know, Jane, that is curious." Colonel Melchett was facing a much annoyed hotel manager. With him was Superintendent Harper of the Glenshire Police and the inevitable Inspector Slack, the latter rather disgruntled at the Chief Constable's wilful usurpation of the case. Superintendent Harper was inclined to be soothing with the almost tearful Mr. Prescott. Colonel Melchett tended towards a blunt brutality. "No good crying over spilt milk," he said sharply. "The girl's dead, strangled. You're lucky that she wasn't strangled in your hotel. This puts the inquiry in a different county and lets your establishment down extremely lightly. But certain inquiries have got to be made, and the sooner we get on with it, the better. You can trust us to be discreet and tactful. So I suggest you cut the cackle and come to the horses. Just what exactly do you know about the girl?"
"I knew nothing of her. Nothing at all. Josie brought her here."
"Josie's been here some time?"
2 years. No, three."
"And you like her?"
"Yes. Josie's a good girl. A nice girl. Competent. She gets on with people and smooths over differences. Bridge, you know, is a touchy sort of game."
Colonel Melchett nodded feelingly. His wife was a keen but an extremely bad bridge player. Mr. Prescott went on, "Josie was very good at calming down unpleasantnesses. She could handle people well, sort of bright and firm, if you know what I mean." Again Melchett nodded. He knew now what it was Miss Josephine Turner had reminded him of. In spite of the make-up and the smart turnout, there was a distinct touch of the nursery governess about her. "I depend upon her," went on Mr. Prescott. His manner became aggrieved. "What does she want to go playing about on slippery rocks in that damn fool way? We've got a nice beach here. Why couldn't she bathe from that? Slipping and falling and breaking her ankle? It wasn't fair on me. I pay her to dance and play bridge and keep people happy and amused, not to go bathing off rocks and breaking her ankle. Dancers ought to be careful of their ankles, not take risks. I was very annoyed about it. Wasn't fair to the hotel." Melchett cut the recital short. "And then she suggested this girl, her cousin, coming down." Prescott assented grudgingly. "That's right. It sounded quite a good idea. Mind you, I wasn't going to pay anything extra. The girl could have her keep, but as for salary, that would have to be fixed up between her and Josie. That's the way it was arranged. I didn't know anything about the girl."
"But she turned out all right."
"Oh, yes, there wasn't anything wrong with her. Not to look at, anyway. She was very young, of course. Rather cheap in style, perhaps, for a place of this kind, but nice manners, quiet and well-behaved, danced well. People liked her."
"Pretty?"
It had been a question hard to answer from a view of the blue, swollen face. Mr. Prescott considered.
Fair to middling. Bit weaselly, if you know what I mean. Wouldn't have been much without make-up. As it was, she managed to look quite attractive."
"Many young men hanging about after her?"
"I know what you're trying to get at, sir." Mr. Prescott became excited. "I never saw anything, nothing special. One or two of the boys hung around a bit, but all in the day's work, so to speak. Nothing in the strangling line, I'd say. She got on well with the older people, too. Had a kind of prattling way with her. Seemed quite a kid, if you know what I mean. It amused them."
Superintendent Harper said in a deep, melancholy voice, "Mr. Jefferson, for instance?" The manager agreed.
"Yes, Mr. Jefferson was the one I had in mind. She used to sit with him and his family a lot. He used to take her out for drives sometimes. Mr. Jefferson's very fond of young people and very good to them. I don't want to have any misunderstanding. Mr. Jefferson's a cripple. He can't get about much. Only way his wheelchair will take him. But he's always keen on seeing young people enjoy themselves, watches the tennis and the bathing and all that, and gives parties for young people here. He likes youth, and there's nothing bitter about him, as there well might be. A very popular gentleman, and I'd say a very fine character."
Melchett asked, "And he took an interest in Ruby Keene?"
"Her talk amused him, I think."
"Did his family share his liking for her?"
"They were always very pleasant to her."
Harper said,
"And it was he who reported the fact of her being missing to the police?"
He contrived to put into the word a significance and a reproach to which the manager instantly responded.
"Put yourself in my place, Mr. Harper. I didn't dream for a minute anything was wrong. Mr. Jefferson came along to my office, storming and all worked up. The girl hadn't slept in her room. She hadn't appeared in her dance last night. She must have gone for a drive and had an accident, perhaps. The police must be informed at once. Inquiries made. In a state he was, and quite high-handed. He rang up the police station then and there. Without consulting Miss Turner? Oh, Josie didn't like it much, I could see that. She was very annoyed about the whole thing. Annoyed with Ruby, I mean. But what could she say? "I think," said Melchett, "we'd better see Mr. Jefferson. Eh, Harper?"
Superintendent Harper agreed.
Mr. Prescott went up with them to Conway Jefferson's suite. It was on the first floor, overlooking the sea. Melchett said carelessly, "Does himself pretty well, eh? Rich man?"
"Oh, very well off indeed, I believe. Nothing's ever stinted when he comes here. Best rooms reserved. Food usually a la carte, expensive wines, best of everything."
Melchett nodded. Mr. Prescott tapped on the outer door, and a woman's voice said, "Come in." The manager entered, the others behind him. Mr. Prescott's manner was apologetic as he spoke to the woman, who turned her head at their entrance from her seat by the window.
"I am so sorry to disturb you, Mrs. Jefferson, but these gentlemen are from the police. They are very anxious to have a word with Mr. Jefferson. Colonel Melchett, Superintendent Harper, Inspector Slack, Mrs. Jefferson."
Mrs. Jefferson acknowledged the introduction by bending her head. A plain woman was Melchett's first impression. Then, as a slight smile came to her lips and she spoke, he changed his opinion. She had a singularly charming and sympathetic voice, and her eyes, clear hazel eyes, were beautiful. She was quietly but not unbecomingly dressed, and was, he judged, about 35 years of age. She said, "My father-in-law is asleep. He is not strong at all, and this affair has been a terrible shock to him. We had to have the doctor, and the doctor gave him a sedative. As soon as he wakes, he will, I know, want to see you. In the meantime, perhaps I can help you. Won't you sit down?"
Mr. Prescott, anxious to escape, said to Colonel Melchett, "Well, if that's all I can do for you," and thankfully received permission to depart. With his closing of the door behind him, the atmosphere took on a mellow and more social quality. Adelaide Jefferson had the power of creating a restful atmosphere. She was a woman who never seemed to say anything remarkable, but who succeeded in stimulating other people to talk and setting them at their ease. She struck now the right note when she said, "This business has shocked us all very much. We saw quite a lot of the poor girl, you know. It seems quite unbelievable. My father-in-law is terribly upset. He was very fond of Ruby."
Colonel Melchett said, "It was Mr. Jefferson, I understand, who reported her disappearance to the police."
He wanted to see exactly how she would react to that. There was a flicker, just a flicker, of annoyance, concern. He could not say what exactly, but there was something, and it seemed to him she had definitely to brace herself, as though to an unpleasant task, before going on. She said, "Yes, that is so. Being an invalid, he gets easily upset and worried. We tried to persuade him that it was all right, that there was some natural explanation, and that the girl herself would not like the police being notified. He insisted. Well," she made a slight gesture, "he was right, and we were wrong."
Melchett asked, "Exactly how well did you know Ruby Keene, Mrs. Jefferson?"
She considered. "It's difficult to say. My father-in-law is very fond of young people and likes to have them round him. Ruby was a new type to him. He was amused and interested by her chatter. She sat with us a good deal in the hotel, and my father-in-law took her out for drives in the car." Her voice was quite noncommittal. Melchett thought to himself, she could say more if she chose.
He said, "Will you tell me what you can of the course of events last night?"
"Certainly, but there is very little that will be useful, I'm afraid. After dinner, Ruby came and sat with us in the lounge. She remained even after the dancing had started. We had arranged to play bridge later, but we were waiting for Mark. That is, Mark Gaskell, my brother-in-law. He married Mr. Jefferson's daughter, you know, who had some important letters to write, and also for Josie. She was going to make a fourth with us." Did that often happen?
Oh, quite frequently. She's a first-class player, of course, and very nice. My father-in-law is a keen bridge player, and whenever possible liked to get hold of Josie to make the fourth instead of an outsider. Naturally, as she has to arrange the fours, she can't always play with us, but she does whenever she can. And as her eyes smiled a little, my father-in-law spends a lot of money in the hotel. The management are quite pleased for Josie to favour us.
Melchett asked, "You like Josie?"
"Yes, I do. She's always good-humoured and cheerful, works hard and seems to enjoy her job. She's shrewd, though not well-educated, and, well, never pretends about anything. She's natural and unaffected."
"Please go on, Mrs. Jefferson."
"As I say, Josie had to get her bridge fours arranged, and Mark was writing, so Ruby sat and talked with us a little longer than usual. Then Josie came along, and Ruby went off to do her first solo dance with Raymond. He's the dance and tennis professional. She came back to us afterwards, just as Mark joined us. Then she went off to dance with a young man, and we four started our bridge." She stopped, and made a slight, insignificant gesture of helplessness. "And that's all I know. I just caught a glimpse of her once, dancing, but bridge is an absorbing game, and I hardly glanced through the glass partition at the ballroom. Then, at midnight, Raymond came along to Josie very upset, and asked where Ruby was. Josie naturally tried to shut him up, but—" Superintendent Harper interrupted. He said in his quiet voice, "Why, naturally, Mrs. Jefferson?" "Well—" She hesitated, looked, Melchett thought, a little put out. "Josie didn't want the girl's absence made too much of. She considered herself responsible for her, in a way. She said Ruby was probably up in her bedroom, said the girl had talked about having a headache earlier. I don't think that was true, by the way. Josie just said it by way of excuse. Raymond went off and telephoned up to Ruby's room, but apparently there was no answer, and he came back in rather a state. Temperamental, you know. Josie went off with him and tried to soothe him down, and in the end she danced with him instead of Ruby. Rather plucky of her, because you could see afterwards it had hurt her ankle. She came back to us when the dance was over, and tried to calm down Mr. Jefferson. He'd got worked up by then. We persuaded him, in the end, to go to bed. Told him Ruby had probably gone for a spin in a car, and that they'd had a puncture. He went to bed worried, and this morning he began to agitate at once." She paused. "The rest you know."
"Thank you, Mrs. Jefferson. Now, I'm going to ask you if you've any idea who could have done this thing."
She said immediately, "No idea whatever. I'm afraid I can't help you in the slightest." He pressed her.
"The girl never said anything? Nothing about jealousy? About some man she was afraid of, or intimate with?"
Adelaide Jefferson shook her head to each query.
"There seemed nothing more that she could tell them. The superintendent suggested that they should interview young George Bartlett, and return to see Mr. Jefferson later. Colonel Melchett agreed, and the three men went out. Mrs. Jefferson promised to send word as soon as Mr. Jefferson was awake."
"Nice woman," said the Colonel, as they closed the door behind them.
"A very nice lady indeed," said Superintendent Harper. George Bartlett was a thin, lanky youth, with a prominent Adam's apple, and an immense difficulty in saying what he meant. He was in such a state of dither that it was hard to get a calm statement from him. "I say, it is awful, isn't it? Sort of thing one reads about in the Sunday papers, but one doesn't feel it really happens, don't you know?"
"Unfortunately, there is no doubt about it, Mr. Bartlett," said the superintendent.
No, of course not. But it seems so rum, somehow, and miles from here and everything in some country house, wasn't it? Awfully county and all that. Created a bit of a stir in the neighbourhood, what?"
Colonel Melchett took charge.
"How well did you know the dead girl, Mr. Bartlett?"
George Bartlett looked alarmed.
"Oh, not well at all, sir. No, hardly at all, if you know what I mean. Dance with her once or twice, pass the time of day, bit of tennis, you know."
"You were, I think, the last person to see her alive last night."
"Oh, I suppose I was. Doesn't it sound awful? I mean, she was perfectly all right when I saw her. Absolutely."
"What time was that, Mr. Bartlett?"
"Well, you know, I never know about time. Wasn't very late, if you know what I mean."
"You danced with her?"
Yes. As a matter of fact, well, "Yes, I did. Early on in the evening, though. Tell you what, it was just after her exhibition dance with the pro fellow. Must have been 10, 11:30, I don't know."
"Never mind the time, we can fix that. Please tell us exactly what happened."
"Well, we danced, don't you know? Not that I'm much of a dancer."
"How you dance is not really relevant, Mr. Bartlett."
George Bartlett cast an alarmed eye on the Colonel and stammered, No, I suppose it isn't. Well, as I say, we danced, round and round, and I talked, but Ruby didn't say very much, and she yawned a bit. As I say, I don't dance awfully well, and so girls, well, inclined to give it a miss, if you know what I mean. She said she had a headache. I know where I get off, so I said, righty-ho, and that was that.
What was the last you saw of her?
She went off upstairs.
She said nothing about meeting anyone, or going for a drive, or having a date? The Colonel used the colloquial expression with a slight effort. Bartlett shook his head.
Not to me. He looked rather mournful. Just gave me the push.
What was her manner? Did she seem anxious, abstracted, anything on her mind?
George Bartlett considered. Then he shook his head. Seemed a bit bored. Yawned, as I said. Nothing more.
Colonel Melchett said, And what did you do, Mr. Bartlett?
Eh?
What did you do when Ruby Keene left you?
George Bartlett gaped at him. Let's see now. What did I do?
We are waiting for you to tell us.
Oh, yes, of course. Jolly difficult remembering things, what? Let me see. Shouldn't be surprised if I went into the bar and had a drink.
Did you go into the bar and have a drink?
That's just it. I did have a drink. Don't think it was just then. Have an idea I wandered out, don't you know? Bit of air. Rather stuffy for September. Very nice outside. Yes, that's it. I strolled around a bit, then I came in and had a drink, and then I strolled back to the ballroom. Wasn't much doing. Noticed what's-her-name, Josie, was dancing again with the tennis fellow. She'd been on the sick list, twisted ankle or something.
That fixes the time of your return at midnight. Do you intend us to understand that you spent over an hour walking about outside?
Well, I had a drink, you know. I was thinking of things.
This statement received more credulity than any other. Colonel Melchett said sharply, What were you thinking about?
Oh, I don't know, things, said Mr. Bartlett vaguely.
You have a car, Mr. Bartlett.
Oh, yes, I've got a car.
Where was it? In the hotel garage?
No, it was in the courtyard, as a matter of fact. Thought I might go for a spin, you see.
Perhaps you did go for a spin.
No, I didn't. I swear I didn't.
You didn't, for instance, take Miss Keene for a spin?
Oh, I see. Look here, what are you getting at? I didn't. I swear I didn't. Really, now.
Thank you, Mr. Bartlett. I don't think there's anything more at present.
At present, repeated Colonel Melchett, with a good deal of emphasis on the words. They left Mr. Bartlett looking after them with a ludicrous expression of alarm on his unintellectual face.
Brainless young ass, said Colonel Melchett.
Or isn't he?
Superintendent Harper shook his head. We've got a long way to go, he said.
Neither the night porter nor the barman proved helpful. The night porter remembered ringing up to Miss Keene's room just after midnight and getting no reply. He had not noticed Mr. Bartlett leaving or entering the hotel. A lot of gentlemen and ladies were strolling in and out, the night being fine, and there were side doors off the corridor as well as the one in the main hall. He was fairly certain Miss Keene had not gone out by the main door, but if she had come down from her room, which was on the first floor, there was a staircase next to it, and a door out at the end of the corridor, leading onto the side terrace. She could have gone out of that unseen easily enough. It was not locked until the dancing was over at 2 o'clock. The barman remembered Mr. Bartlett being in the bar the preceding evening, but could not say when. Somewhere about the middle of the evening, he thought. Mr. Bartlett had sat against the wall and was looking rather melancholy. He did not know how long he was there. There were a lot of outside guests coming and going in the bar. He had noticed Mr. Bartlett, but he couldn't fix the time in any way. As they left the bar, they were accosted by a small boy of about 9 years old. He burst immediately into excited speech.
"I say, are you the detectives? I'm Peter Carmody. It was my grandfather, Mr. Jefferson, who rang up the police about Ruby. Are you from Scotland Yard? You don't mind my speaking to you, do you?"
Colonel Melchett looked as though he were about to return a short answer, but Superintendent Harper intervened. He spoke benignly and heartily.
"That's all right, my son. Naturally interests you, I expect."
"You bet it does. Do you like detective stories? I do. I read them all. And I've got autographs from Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie and Dixon Carr and H.C. Bailey. Will the murder be in the papers?"
"It'll be in the papers, all right," said Superintendent Harper grimly.
"You see, I'm going back to school next week, and I shall tell them all that I knew her, really knew her well."
"What did you think of her, eh?"
Peter considered.
"Well, I didn't like her much. I thought she was rather a stupid sort of girl. Mum and Uncle Mark didn't like her much either. Only Grandfather. Grandfather wants to see you, by the way. Edwards is looking for you."
Superintendent Harper murmured encouragingly.
"So, your mother and your Uncle Mark didn't like Ruby Keene much. Why was that?"
"Oh, I don't know. She was all sputting in, and they didn't like Grandfather making such a fuss of her." "I expect," said Peter cheerfully, "that they're glad she's dead."
Superintendent Harper looked at him thoughtfully. He said,
"Did you hear them say so?"
"Well, not exactly. Uncle Mark said, 'Well, it's one way out anyway,' and Mum said, 'Yes, but such a horrible one,' and Uncle Mark said it was no good being hypocritical."
The men exchanged glances. At that moment, a respectable, clean-shaven man, neatly dressed in blue serge, came up to them.
"Excuse me, gentlemen, I am Mr. Jefferson's valet. He is awake now and sent me to find you, as he is very anxious to see you."
Once more they went up to Conway Jefferson's suite. In the sitting room, Adelaide Jefferson was talking to a tall, restless man who was prowling nervously about the room. He swung round sharply to view the newcomers.
"Oh, yes. Glad you've come. My father-in-law's been asking for you. He's awake now. Keep him as calm as you can, won't you? His health's not too good. It's a wonder, really, that this shock didn't do for him."
Harper said, "I'd no idea his health was as bad as that."
"He doesn't know it himself," said Mark Gaskell. "It's his heart, you see. The doctor warned Addie that he mustn't be overexcited or startled. He more or less hinted that the end might come any time, didn't he, Addie?"
Mrs. Jefferson nodded. She said, "It's incredible that he's rallied the way he has."
Melchett said dryly, "Murder isn't exactly a soothing incident. We'll be as careful as we can."
He was sizing up Mark Gaskell as he spoke. He didn't much care for the fellow. A bold, unscrupulous, hawk-like face. One of those men who usually get their own way and whom women frequently admire.
"But not the sort of fellow I'd trust," the colonel thought to himself. Unscrupulous, that was the word for him. The sort of fellow who wouldn't stick at anything.
In the big bedroom overlooking the sea, Conway Jefferson was sitting in his wheeled chair by the window. No sooner were you in the room with him than you felt the power and magnetism of the man. It was as though the injuries which had left him a cripple had resulted in concentrating the vitality of his shattered body into a narrower and more intense focus. He had a fine head, the red of the hair slightly grizzled. The face was rugged and powerful, deeply suntanned, and the eyes were a startling blue. There was no sign of illness or feebleness about him. The deep lines on his face were the lines of suffering, not the lines of weakness. Here was a man who would never rail against fate, but accept it and pass on to victory. He said,
"I'm glad you've come."
His quick eyes took them in. He said to Melchett, "You're the chief constable of Radfordshire?"
"Right. And you're Superintendent Harper. Sit down. Cigarettes on the table beside you."
They thanked him and sat down. Melchett said,
I understand, Mr. Jefferson, that you were interested in the dead girl.
A quick, twisted smile flashed across the lined face.
Yes, they'll all have told you that. Well, it's no secret. How much has my family said to you?
He looked quickly from one to the other as he asked the question.
It was Melchett who answered. Mrs. Jefferson told us very little, beyond the fact that the girl's chatter amused you, and that she was by way of being a protégé. We have only exchanged half a dozen words with Mr. Gaskell.
Conway Jefferson smiled.
Addie's a discreet creature, bless her. Mark would probably have been more outspoken. I think, Melchett, that I'd better tell you some facts rather fully. It's important, in order that you should understand my attitude. And, to begin with, it's necessary that I go back to the big tragedy of my life. 8 years ago, I lost my wife, my son, and my daughter in an aeroplane accident. Since then, I've been like a man who's lost half himself. And I'm not speaking of my physical plight. I was a family man. My daughter-in-law and my son-in-law have been very good to me. They've done all they can to take the place of my flesh and blood. But I've realized, especially of late, that they have, after all, their own lives to live. So you must understand that, essentially, I'm a lonely man. I like young people. I enjoy them. Once or twice I've played with the idea of adopting some girl or boy. During this last month I got very friendly with the child who's been killed. She was absolutely natural, completely naive. She chattered on about her life and her experiences, in pantomime, with touring companies, with Mum and Dad as a child in cheap lodgings. Such a different life from any I've known. Never complaining, never seeing it as sordid. Just a natural, uncomplaining, hard-working child, unspoilt and charming. Not a lady, perhaps, but, thank God, neither vulgar nor, abominable word, ladylike. I got more and more fond of Ruby. I decided, gentlemen, to adopt her legally. She would become, by law, my daughter. That, I hope, explains my concern for her, and the steps I took when I heard of her unaccountable disappearance.
There was a pause. Then Superintendent Harper, his unemotional voice robbing the question of any offence, asked, "May I ask what your son-in-law and daughter-in-law said to that?" Jefferson's answer came back quickly.
What could they say? They didn't perhaps like it very much. It's the sort of thing that arouses prejudice, but they behaved very well. Yeah, very well. It's not as though, you see, they were dependent on me. When my son, Frank, married, I turned over half my worldly goods to him then and there. I believe in that. Don't let your children wait until you're dead. They want the money when they're young, not when they're middle-aged. In the same way, when my daughter Rosamond insisted on marrying a poor man, I settled a big sum of money on her. That sum passed to him at her death. So, you see, that simplified the matter from the financial angle.
I see, Mr. Jefferson, said Superintendent Harper. But there was a certain reserve in his tone.
Conway Jefferson pounced upon it. But you don't agree, eh?
It's not for me to say, sir, but families, in my experience, don't always act reasonably.
I dare say you're right, Superintendent, but you must remember that Mr. Gaskell and Mrs. Jefferson aren't, strictly speaking, my family. They're not blood relations.
Oh, that, of course, makes a difference, admitted the superintendent. For a moment Conway Jefferson's eyes twinkled. He said,
"That's not to say that they didn't think me an old fool. That would be the average person's reaction. But I wasn't being a fool. I know character. With education and polishing, Ruby Keene could have taken her place anywhere."
Melchett said,
"I'm afraid we are being rather impertinent and inquisitive, but it's important that we should get at all the facts. You proposed to make full provision for the girl, that is, settle money upon her, but you hadn't already done so?"
Jefferson said,
"I understand what you're driving at, the possibility of someone's benefiting by the girl's death. But nobody could. The necessary formalities for legal adoption were underway, but they hadn't yet been completed."
Melchett said slowly. "Then if anything happened to you?" He left the sentence unfinished as a query. Conway Jefferson was quick to respond.
Nothing's likely to happen to me. I'm a cripple, but I'm not an invalid. Although doctors do like to pull long faces and give advice about not overdoing things. Not overdoing things. I'm as strong as a horse. Still, I am quite aware of the fatalities of life. My God, I've good reason to be. Sudden death comes to the strongest man, especially in these days of road casualties. But I'd provided for that. I made a new will about 10 days ago.
Yes? Superintendent Harper leaned forward.
I left the sum of £50,000 to be held in trust for Ruby Keene until she was 25, when she would come into the principal.
Superintendent Harper's eyes opened. So did Colonel Melchett's. Harper said in an almost awed voice, "That's a very large sum of money, Mr. Jefferson."
"In these days, yes, it is."
"And you were leaving it to a girl you had only known a few weeks?" Anger flashed into the vivid blue eyes.
"Must I go on repeating the same thing over and over again? I've no flesh and blood of my own, no nieces or nephews or distant cousins even. I might have left it to charity. I prefer to leave it to an individual."
He laughed.
"Cinderella turned into a princess overnight. A fairy godfather instead of a fairy godmother. Why not? It's my money. I made it."
Colonel Melchett asked, "Any other bequests?"
"A small legacy to Edwards, my valet, and the remainder to Mark and Addie in equal shares."
"Would—excuse me—the residue amount to a large sum?"
"Probably not. It's difficult to say exactly. Investments fluctuate all the time. The sum involved, after death duties and expenses had been paid, would probably have come to something between £5,000 and £10,000 net."
"I see.
And you needn't think I was treating them shabbily. As I said, I divided up my estate at the time my children married. I left myself, actually, a very small sum. But after the tragedy, I wanted something to occupy my mind. I flung myself into business. At my house in London, I had a private line put in, connecting my bedroom to my office. I worked hard. It helped me not to think. And it made me feel that my mutilation had not vanquished me. I threw myself into work."
His voice took on a deeper note. He spoke more to himself than to his audience.
"And by some subtle irony, everything I did prospered. My wildest speculations succeeded. If I gambled, I won. Everything I touched turned to gold. Fate's ironic way of writing the balance, I suppose."
The lines of suffering stood out on his face again. Recollecting himself, he smiled wryly at them.
"So, you see, the sum of money I left Ruby was indisputably mine to do with as my fancy dictated."
Melchett said quickly,
"Oh, undoubtedly, my dear fellow, we're not questioning that for a moment."
Conway Jefferson said, "Good. Now, I want to ask some questions in my turn, if I may. I want to hear more about this terrible business. All I know is that that little Ruby was found strangled in a house some 20 miles from here."
"That is correct, at Gossington Hall."
Jefferson frowned.
"Gossington? But that's Colonel Bantry's house."
"Bantry? Arthur Bantry? But I know him. Know him and his wife. Met them abroad some years ago. I didn't realize they lived in this part of the world. Why, it's..." He broke off.
Superintendent Harper slipped in smoothly. "Colonel Bantry was dining in the hotel here Tuesday of last week. You didn't see him?"
"Tuesday? Tuesday?
No, we were back late. Went over to Harden Head and had dinner on the way back."
Melchett said,
"Ruby Keene never mentioned the Bantries to you?"
Jefferson shook his head.
"Never. Don't believe she knew them. Sure she didn't.
She didn't know anybody but theatrical folk and that sort of thing.
He paused and then asked abruptly,
"What's Bantry got to say about it?" "He can't account for it in the least. He was out at a Conservative meeting last night. The body was discovered this morning. He says he's never seen the girl in his life."
Jefferson nodded.
He said, "It certainly seems fantastic."
Superintendent Harper cleared his throat. He said, "Have you any idea at all, sir, who can have done this?"
"Good God, I wish I had."
The veins stood out on his forehead.
"It's incredible. Unimaginable. I'd say it couldn't have happened if it hadn't happened."
"There's no friend of hers from her past life, no man hanging about or threatening her?"
"I'm sure there isn't. She'd have told me if so. She's never had a regular boyfriend. She told me so herself."
Superintendent Harper thought, "Yes, I dare say that's what she told you, but that's as may be." Conway Jefferson went on,
"Josie would know better than anyone if there had been some man hanging about Ruby or pestering her. Can't she help?"
"She says not."
Jefferson said, frowning, "I can't help feeling it must be the work of some maniac. Well, the brutality of the method, breaking into a country house, the whole thing so unconnected and senseless. There are men of that type, men outwardly sane, but who decoy girls, sometimes children, away and kill them. Sexual crimes, really, I suppose."
Harper said, "Oh, yes, there are such cases, but we've no knowledge of anyone of that kind operating in this neighbourhood." Jefferson went on,
"I've thought over all the various men I've seen with Ruby, guests here and outsiders, men she'd danced with. They all seem harmless enough, the usual type. She had no special friend of any kind."
Superintendent Harper's face remained quite impassive, but unseen by Conway Jefferson, there was still a speculative glint in his eye. It was quite possible, he thought, that Ruby Keene might have had a special friend, even though Conway Jefferson did not know about it. He said nothing, however. The Chief Constable gave him a glance of inquiry and then rose to his feet. He said, "Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. That's all we need for the present." Jefferson said, "You'll keep me informed of your progress?"
"Oh, yes, yes, we'll keep in touch with you."
The two men went out. Conway Jefferson leaned back in his chair. His eyelids came down and veiled the fierce blue of his eyes. He suddenly looked a very tired man. Then, after a minute or two, the lids flickered. He called,
"Edwards!"
From the next room the valet appeared promptly. Edwards knew his master as no one else did. Others, even his nearest, knew only his strength. Edwards knew his weakness. He had seen Conway Jefferson tired, discouraged, weary of life, momentarily defeated by infirmity and loneliness.
"Yes, sir?"
Jefferson said.
"Get on to Sir Henry Clithering. He's at Melbourne Abbas. Ask him, from me, to get here today, if he can, instead of tomorrow. Tell him it's urgent."
When they were outside Jefferson's door, Superintendent Harper said, "Well, for what it's worth, we've got a motive, sir."
Said Melchett. £50,000, eh?"
"Yes, sir.
Murder's been done for a good deal less than that."
"Yes, but..."
Colonel Melchett left the sentence unfinished. Harper, however, understood him.
"You don't think it's likely in this case?"
"Well, I don't either, as far as that goes. But it's got to be gone into all the same."
"Oh, of course."
Harper went on.
"If, as Mr. Jefferson says, Mr. Gaskell and Mrs. Jefferson are already well provided for, and in receipt of a comfortable income, well, it's not likely they'd set out to do a brutal murder."
"Quite so. Their financial standing will have to be investigated, of course. Can't say I like the appearance of Gaskell much. Looks a sharp, unscrupulous sort of fellow. But that's a long way from making him out a murderer."
"Oh, yes, sir. As I say, I don't think it's likely to be either of them. And from what Josie said, I don't see how it would have been humanly possible. They were both playing bridge from 11:20 until midnight. No, to my mind, there's another possibility, much more likely."
Melchett said,
Boyfriend of Ruby Keene's? That's it, sir. Some disgruntled young fellow? Not too strong in the head, perhaps. Someone I'd say she knew before she came here. This adoption scheme, if he got wise to it, made just to put the lid on things. He saw himself losing her, saw her being removed to a different sphere of life altogether, and he went mad and blind with rage. He got her to come out and meet him last night, had a row with her over it, lost his head completely, and did her in. And how did she come to be in Bantry's library? Well, I think that's feasible. They were out, say, in his car at the time. He came to himself, realized what he'd done, and his first thought was how to get rid of the body. Well, say they were near the gates of a big house at the time. The idea comes to him that if she's found there, the hue and cry will center around the house and its occupants, and will leave him comfortably out of it. She's a little bit of a thing. He could easily carry her. He's got a chisel in the car. He forces a window and plops her down on the hearthrug. Being a strangling case, there's no blood or mess to give him away in the car. See what I mean, sir? Oh, yes, Harper, it's all perfectly possible. But there's still one thing to be done. Cherchez l'homme. What? Oh, yes, very good, sir. Superintendent Harper tactfully applauded his superior's joke, although, owing to the excellence of Colonel Melchett's French accent, he almost missed the sense of the words.
Could I speak to you a minute?
It was George Bartlett who thus waylaid the two men. Colonel Melchett, who was not attracted to Mr. Bartlett and who was anxious to see how Slack had got on with the investigation of the girl's room and the questioning of the chambermaids, barked sharply, "Well, what is it? What is it?" Young Bartlett retreated a step or two, opening and shutting his mouth and giving an unconscious imitation of a fish in a tank.
Probably isn't important, don't you know? Thought I ought to tell you. Matter of fact, can't find my car.
What do you mean, can't find your car? Stammering a good deal, Mr. Bartlett explained that what he meant was that he couldn't find his car. Superintendent Harper said, "Do you mean it's been stolen?" George Bartlett turned gratefully to the more placid voice.
"Well, that's just it, you know. I mean, one can't tell, can one? I mean, someone may have just buzzed off in it, not meaning any harm, if you know what I mean."
"When did you last see it, Mr. Bartlett?"
"Well, I was trying to remember. Funny how difficult it is to remember anything, isn't it?"
Colonel Melchett said coldly, "Not, I should think, to a normal intelligence. I understood you to say just now that it was in the courtyard of the hotel last night."
Mr. Bartlett was bold enough to interrupt. He said, "That's just it. Was it?"
"What do you mean by was it? You said it was."
"Well, I mean, I thought it was. I mean, well, I didn't go out and look, don't you see?"
Colonel Melchett sighed. He summoned all his patience. He said, "Let's get this quite clear. When was the last time you saw, actually saw, your car? What make is it, by the way?"
"Minoan 14.
"And you last saw it when?"
George Bartlett's Adam's apple jerked convulsively up and down. Been trying to think. Had it before lunch yesterday. Was going for a spin in the afternoon, but somehow, you know how it is, went to sleep instead. Then, after tea, had a game of squash and all that, and a bathe afterwards.
And the car was then in the courtyard of the hotel?"
Suppose so. I mean, that's where I put it. Thought, you see, I'd take someone for a spin. After dinner, I mean. But it wasn't my lucky evening. Nothing doing. Never took the old bus out after all."
Harper said, "But as far as you knew, the car was still in the courtyard."
"Well, naturally. I mean, I'd put it there, what?"
"Wouldn't you have noticed if it had not been there?"
Mr. Bartlett shook his head. "Don't think so, you know. Lots of cars going and coming and all that. Plenty of Minoans."
Superintendent Harper nodded. He had just cast a casual glance out of the window,
There were, at that moment, no less than 8 Minoan 14s in the courtyard. It was the popular cheap car of the year.
"Aren't you in the habit of putting your car away at night?" asked Colonel Melchett.
"Don't usually bother," said Mr. Bartlett. "Fine weather and all that, you know. Such a fag putting a car away in a garage."
Glancing at Colonel Melchett, Superintendent Harper said, "I'll join you upstairs, sir. I'll just get hold of Sergeant Higgins, and he can take down particulars from Mr. Bartlett."
"Right, Harper," Mr. Bartlett murmured wistfully. "Thought I ought to let you know. Might be important, what?"
Mr. Prescott had supplied his additional dancer with board and lodging. Whatever the board, the lodging was the poorest the hotel possessed. Josephine Turner and Ruby Keene had occupied rooms at the extreme end of a mean and dingy little corridor. The rooms were small, faced north onto a portion of the cliff that backed the hotel, and were furnished with the odds and ends of suites that had once, some 30 years ago, represented luxury and magnificence in the best suites. Now, when the hotel had been modernized and the bedrooms supplied with built-in receptacles for clothes, these large Victorian oak and mahogany wardrobes were relegated to those rooms occupied by the hotel's resident staff, or given to guests in the height of the season when all the rest of the hotel was full. As Melchett saw at once, the position of Ruby Keene's room was ideal for the purpose of leaving the hotel without being observed, and was particularly unfortunate from the point of view of throwing light on the circumstances of that departure. At the end of the corridor was a small staircase, which led down to an equally obscure corridor on the ground floor. Here there was a glass door, which led out onto the side terrace of the hotel, an unfrequented terrace with no view. You could go from it to the main terrace in front, or you could go down a winding path and come out in a lane that eventually rejoined the cliff road farther along. Its surface being bad, it was seldom used. Inspector Slack had been busy harrying chambermaids and examining Ruby's room for clues. He had been lucky enough to find the room exactly as it had been left the night before. Ruby Keene had not been in the habit of rising early. Her usual procedure, Slack discovered, was to sleep until about 10 or 10:30, and then ring for breakfast. Consequently, since Conway Jefferson had begun his representations to the manager very early, the police had taken charge of things before the chambermaids had touched the room. They had actually not been down that corridor at all. The other rooms there, at this season of the year, were only opened and dusted once a week. "That's all to the good, as far as it goes," Slack explained gloomily. "It means that if there were anything to find, we'd find it. But there isn't anything." The Glenshire police had already been over the room for fingerprints, but there were none unaccounted for. Ruby's own, Josie's, and the two chambermaids, one on the morning and one on the evening shift. There were also a couple of prints made by Raymond Starr, but these were accounted for by his story that he'd come up with Josie to look for Ruby when she did not appear for the midnight exhibition dance. There had been a heap of letters and general rubbish in the pigeonholes of the massive mahogany desk in the corner. Slack had just been carefully sorting through them, but he had found nothing of a suggestive nature. Bills, receipts, theatre programmes, cinema stubs, newspaper cuttings, beauty hints torn from magazines. Of the letters, there were some from Lil, apparently a friend from the Palais de Danse, recounting various affairs and gossip, saying they missed Rube a lot. "Mr. Finderson asked after you ever so often. Quite put out he is. Young Reg has taken up with May, now you've gone. Barney asks after you now and then. Things going much as usual. Old Grouse is still as mean as ever with us girls. He ticked off Ada for going about with a fellow." Slack had carefully noted all the names mentioned. Inquiries would be made, and it was possible some useful information might come to light. To this, Colonel Melchett agreed. So did Superintendent Harper, who had joined them. Otherwise, the room had little to yield in the way of information. Across a chair in the middle of the room was the foamy pink dance frock Ruby had worn early in the evening, with a pair of pink satin high-heeled shoes kicked off carelessly on the floor. Two sheer silk stockings were rolled into a ball and flung down. One
had a ladder in it. Melchett recalled that the dead girl had had bare feet and legs. This, Slack learnt, was her custom. She used makeup on her legs instead of stockings, and only sometimes wore stockings for dancing, by this means saving expense. The wardrobe door was open, and showed a variety of rather flashy evening dresses and a row of shoes below. There was some soiled underwear in the clothes basket, some nail parings, soiled face-cleaning tissue, and bits of cotton wool stained with rouge and nail polish in the waste paper basket. In fact, nothing out of the ordinary. The facts seemed plain to read. Ruby Keene had hurried upstairs, changed her clothes, and hurried off again. Where? Josephine Turner, who might be supposed to know most of Ruby's life and friends, had proved unable to help. But this, as Inspector Slack pointed out, might be natural. If what you tell me is true, sir, about this adoption business, I mean, well, Josie would be all for Ruby breaking with any old friend she might have and who might queer the pitch, so to speak. As I see it, this invalid gentleman gets all worked up about Ruby Keene being such a sweet, innocent, childish little piece of goods. Now, supposing Ruby's got a tough boyfriend. That won't go down so well with the old boy. So, it's Ruby's business to keep that dark. Josie doesn't know much about the girl anyway, not about her friends and all that, but one thing she wouldn't stand for, Ruby's messing up things by carrying on with some undesirable fellow. So, it stands to reason that Ruby, who, as I see it, was a sly little piece, would keep very dark about seeing any old friend. She wouldn't let on to Josie anything about it. Otherwise Josie would say, "No, you don't, my girl." But you know what girls are, especially young ones, always ready to make a fool of themselves over a tough guy. Ruby wants to see him. He comes down here, cuts up rough about the whole business, and wrings the girl's neck. "I expect you're right, Slack," said Colonel Melchett, disguising his usual repugnance for the unpleasant way Slack had of putting things. "If so, we ought to be able to discover this tough friend's identity fairly easily." "Oh, you leave it to me, sir," said Slack, with his usual confidence. "I'll get hold of this Lil girl at that Palais de Danse place and turn her right inside out. We'll soon get at the truth." Colonel Melchett wondered if they would. Slack's energy and activity always made him feel tired. "There's one other person you might be able to get a tip from, sir," went on Slack, "and that's the dance and tennis pro fellow. He must have seen a lot of her, and he'd know more than Josie would. Likely enough she'd loosen her tongue a bit to him." "I have already discussed that point with Superintendent Harper." "Good, sir. I've done the chambermaids pretty thoroughly. They don't know a thing. Look down on these two, as far as I can make out. Scamped the service as much as they dared. Chambermaid was in here last at 7 o'clock last night, when she turned down the bed and drew the curtains and cleared up a bit. There's a bathroom next door, if you'd like to see it." The bathroom was situated between Ruby's room and the slightly larger room occupied by Josie. It was illuminating. Colonel Melchett silently marvelled at the amount of aids to beauty that women could use. Rows of jars of face cream, cleansing cream, vanishing cream, skin-feeding cream, boxes of different shades of powder, an untidy heap of every variety of lipstick, hair lotions and brightening applications, eyelash black, mascara, blue stain for under the eyes, at least 12 different shades of nail varnish, face tissues, bits of cotton wool, dirty powder puffs, bottles of lotion, astringent, tonic, soothing, etc. "Do you mean to say," he murmured feebly, "that women use all these things?" Inspector Slack, who always knew everything, kindly enlightened him. "In private life, sir, so to speak, a lady keeps to one or two distinct shades, one for evening, one for day. They know what suits them, and they keep to it. But these professional girls, they have to ring a change, so to speak. They do exhibition dances, and one night it's a tango, and the next a crinoline Victorian dance, and then a kind of a pash dance, and then just ordinary ballroom, and of course the make-up varies a good bit." "Good Lord," said the Colonel. "No wonder the people who turn out these creams and messes make a fortune." "Oh, easy money, that's what it is," said Slack. "Easy money. Got to spend a bit in advertisement, of course."
Colonel Melchett jerked his mind away from the fascinating and age-long problem of women's adornments. He said to Harper, who had just joined them, "There's still this dancing fellow. Your pigeon, Superintendent?"
"I suppose so, sir."
As they went downstairs, Harper asked, "What did you think of Mr. Bartlett's story, sir? About his car? I think, Harper, that that young man wants watching. It's a fishy story. Supposing that he did take Ruby Keene out in that car last night, after all."
End of Disc 2. Please continue with the next disc.